Welcome to the Jolly Cello Master. I'm your host, Jochen Heusner, and tonight I'll be talking to Addison Rex, who has quite an interesting story in wine. He has worked at every level in wineries. He's the head of wine consultancy Jurassic Wine, but what clearly stands out is his role as agent crew at WineSpires, an e-commerce company with a quite distinctive story. Here we go.
So, first question I have to ask you, who am I talking to tonight? Is it Addison or should I call you agent crew? Or I was like, what do you like to be called?
Thank you for having me. It's funny because agent crew is really what I go by most often these days, which is hilarious because, you know, when I worked for my family's winery for a long time, I mean, it was definitely being Addison Rex was, you know, the part of the job being myself. And so when I came to Wine Spies, we really do, you know, live the brand and we all had secret agent code names. And at first it was kind of hard for me to go undercover, so to speak. But nowadays it's so funny. I really like being called agent crew, and most people in the industry these days just call me crew. So yeah, feel free.
That's pretty cool.
My spy shades. A lot of times I'm wearing my secret agent glasses.
Yeah, I mean, it's like for those that don't know Wine Spies, and obviously we're here in Europe, obviously we don't usually come across like the e-commerce websites in the US. Like, maybe you can, I mean, it's like if you look at the website, looks amazing, looks very interesting. How did you come up with that?
Yeah, so the site's been around since 2007, actually, which makes it one of the earliest wine flash sale sites. At the time, Wine Woot, you might be familiar with Woot because they were one of the pioneers of the flash sale model in general, with a short period of time that a single product is available. So we were the third flash sale model site, and a lot of different flash sale sites have come and gone since then, but we're still going strong and growing. So basically the idea is that every 24 hours we feature a specific wine, and then at midnight that wine is gone, never to be seen again. So it's a great model because, you know, there's always that excitement we can find. Simultaneously, we can find smaller lots that, you know, otherwise it would be challenging to find a home for. But also they're big enough that we can kind of serve an audience. So, you know, we'll move anywhere from, you know, a couple hundred cases a day.
Okay.
So it really works out for both sides. And it's just people often think initially, you know, why would a producer want to feature a wine on, you know, on a discount site? Because that is the deal. They're always sold for a deep discount. Yeah. And we do feature wines for, I mean, up to 70% off. And those are real discounts too. They're not just, you know, it's not just a marketing shtick. It really is a good deal. And the reason is, you know, manyfold. People think it's just a closeout type model. But really, I mean, end of vintage, it's very, a lot of times for a large producer, for example, you have an entire sales apparatus, and you almost need enough wine to keep the machine running. And so when you get to the tail end of a vintage and you need to switch over, that is one example of, you know, a time where it's convenient to just be able to take that, you know, small amount of whatever wine is left and make it disappear in a day. So that's for everybody.
Because I was going to ask you, because obviously I looked at your most recent wines or what's currently on, and I found one which I know, which is the Terra di Lavoro by Gallardi. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's a very well known, it's one of the big red wines of the south of Italy. It's a kind of a famous winemaker, Riccardo Quattarella, who's been with them for like many years before now. More recently, he's known for making the wine or being the person behind the wine of Sting. So he's like this is like this is a big wine, and I think you sold it for $39. And I was like thinking, I was like, oh well, that's actually, I bought the same wine the other day, and it's like, and I think like it was the same price in euros. So then obviously you need to kind of like exchange the currency, but that
also it's expensive to get it here.
I was going to say like the transportation, and then it's like, I don't know who else gets paid in on that scale. And it's like, how do you do that? And what is actually the kind of motivation for the winemaker, or it's like the producer to go down that route, because like it's a well-established name and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the key to the rationale, I mean, like, this is, so behind me is my family's winery. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I grew up on that side of the business working for single producer. So I very well understand the desire to, you know, make sure that you're guarding your brand's position. And mm-hmm. so, you know, the psychology of offering a wine at a discount can be confusing on the outside. The main thing is that it's a very short window that this mm-hmm. the discount is being offered, and our customers understand that. Mm-hmm. So you're not even going to be able to go buy that wine from us tomorrow.
Yeah.
And that really is the difference in the comfort level for the producer. Mm-hmm. But as I was saying, you know, there really is you know, it's very, wine is unique in that every single product, there's, you know, it's each SKU is unique. And mm-hmm. when you get to the end of a vintage, you need to switch everything over. So you're running out of that 2017. Well, even that same vineyard designate wine, the 2019, it's a different wine, yeah. A different product. So at the end of the day, when you're talking about, you know, how do you get an import all the way over here and what is the landed cost of it, and then, you know, who's making margin on it, the truth is that we've got, you know, a really extensive network of relationships with producers and distributors and importers. Mm-hmm. And quite often there's just a, you know, a lot of wine that really, again, it just needs a home. Mm-hmm. You know, and it really does work out in terms of, you know, we're able to sell a high volume of wine in 24 hours. Mm-hmm. So, you know, everyone likes getting a single big check. My family's winery, we're actually, the way that I came to Wine Spies in the first place was that I was selling wine to Wine Spies for a very long time. And the founder of the company, Agent Red, he's Agent Red, of course. We got the two founders are Agent Red and Agent White. He's like, man, when are you going to come work for me? When are you going to come work for me? He finally broke me down. But we were actually one of his absolute top wineries. And so I could say from the other side of the deal, I mean, yeah, it's great to be able to get, you know, a big payday after, you know, one day. Typically, you know, so what's behind me is our family's tasting room. We have a 23,000 square foot cave, and the tasting room is at the very heart of it. So it is quite the tourist draw, and you know, we'll get a lot of foot traffic, especially during the busy season, but we'll sell like 10 times as much wine in a single day with Wine Spies than a busy weekend at the winery.
Yeah.
So that's very attractive.
And then Wine Spies, how do you go about like finding those wines? Because obviously you kind of like sell wines from all around the world, and it must be very difficult to get like, yeah, stay on top and keep the relationships directly with wineries, I suppose.
Yeah, that really is the secret to it all. And there's no shortcut there. And that is why there's been so many entrants to the space that, you know, saw it as an attractive business model, but then found it challenging to keep up with trying to feature a different wine every day. Yeah. So our wine curation chief is Agent Noir. He's truly a master. I mean, he's incredibly knowledgeable. He brings with him 30 years worth of contacts. Mm-hmm. On top, he joined us about 2 years ago now, and that's on top of the relationships that we'd already built in over the years since, you know, 2007, like I said.
Mm-hmm.
So what's crazy is that we feature one wine a day. That's 365 wines. But we actually only choose probably one in maybe 20 wines that were submitted. We probably have to drink through well over 2,000 wines. So typically we meet once a week and we get all of the samples that we've been sent.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe out of 30 wines on the table, we'll pick maybe three or four that are good mm-hmm. enough to be featured. So we don't just have to find, you know, some deals. We have to really do 10 times that volume, because the wines that we're even considering are mm-hmm. ones that have kind of already made it through the gauntlet, where okay, the economics work. We think that there's something there. And then we taste the wine. So it really just is all about creating the relationships in the first place. There's no shortcut to that. Mm-hmm. And proving over time that, you know, we're a company that a small producer wants to work with, because we work from everyone from directly from a very small boutique family winery up to a major distributor and importer.
Mm-hmm.
And so those relationships are really very different, and you have to prove for everybody's different business models that that Wine Spies is a great place for a wine to be featured. Our audience is an audience of serious wine consumers who, you know, really you can get a great amount of exposure to the brand, and they'll take it seriously,
How does that work from like a legal perspective? So you are, because like, I mean, how does it work in this like the famous three-tier system? So you're a distributor, you got like your own license, you're selling it direct. So basically one of the guys who's selling it. All right.
So we are licensed as a retailer. Yeah. There's the United States alcohol laws are crazy. Every state is independently regulates alcohol. The federal TTB that bureau actually has very, very little regulatory purview. So every state issues its own set of licenses. So in California, there's a weird hybrid license where we basically have a wholesaler and a retailer license, which is confusing with the three-tier system. But essentially we act as a retailer. That's really what it is. So we buy, but a producer has the right to sell directly to a retailer as well. Mm-hmm. So we can purchase from a producer or we can purchase from a distributor. And then typically, and we could probably talk about this later, but we've been working a lot more with direct importers. Mm-hmm. Typically imports find us through a distributor that we work with already. Mm-hmm. But we're just kind of starting to dip our toes into the direct importation market, which is really exciting. We just last week featured our first wine that was a direct import. I'm sorry. We just landed the deal. It just got to the port. So I was very excited. Yeah,
it's like we've got like our own sets of confusing regulation here, like obviously from a different perspective. And there's always like when you speak with people from the US, and it's like about like the origin of wine, which is like very important to Europeans, or French, Italians, and the rules are quite strict, and which is like for Americans often like hard to understand why we go through all this hassle. And then we see at the same time the regulatory setup for like the sales and distribution in America, which again, like all regulation has grown from like a historical aspect. And like, yeah, it's
it's funny because in Europe, you know, there's so much regulation governing the production of the wine, you know, by region. But for us, there's almost no regulation about production of the wine. Very, very little. The only laws that they actually are at a federal level are basically like label laws saying that, you know, if it says Cabernet on the front label, you have to have X percentage of Cabernet. But even that, I think it's like 80. If you say Cabernet on the front label, I think it only requires it to be 75% Cabernet. Mm. There's 25%. I mean, it might be 85%, but I mean, there's a huge margin for error there. But then on the actual sales side, we make it impossible. So, you know, you've got no regulation of the production. You can grow whatever grapes you want, anywhere you want to grow them. There's no local laws about you must produce Pinot Noir in this region, and these wines from this region need to be produced that way. None of that exists. But on the other hand, you know, all of the 50 states have their own alcohol laws, and they specifically do not cooperate with one another. I mean, that's what's so incredible. I mean, at least I would think the EU tries to at least, you know, create avenues for the different countries to work together. Here, it's like that it's almost combative.
No, it's like it's interesting because like you obviously don't like there are only so many states that are wine producing in the US. It's like it's not like everywhere everyone makes his own wine, tries to protect his own stock. But what I was going to ask because what you just said, like just said, obviously it's very interesting that you have like very little regulation towards the production. But do you think like geographical indications would that help American wines differentiate? Because obviously there are more regions. I like the regulation we talk about now in the US that was like when there was only California, but now California itself has grown so much, and then you have like a lot of new spots that have joined the club since then. Do you think that would be useful to have something like that in the US as well?
Well, no, I think I actually quite like our AVA system. We have a national designation called American Viticultural Areas. That's our version of appellations. And I think it actually works quite well. The problem that we're seeing now, because there has been a massive increase in the number of registered AVAs in recent years, the problem is actually now the opposite, which is that the standards required for a new AVA to be designated are quite low. So essentially, a group of vintners in a given area just need to apply to have an area defined, and there's very little guidance as to what the requirements are. So there's actually a debate going on right now as to try to implement some sort of like that there has to be a burden of proof that there is some sort of unique terroir to a particular area that justifies the granting of an AVA. But the confusing part of our AVA system is that the first, I mean, they can overlap. One can be contained within the other. There are very, very large AVAs and very, very small AVAs. So, unlike many of the European systems where, there's kind of a ring with concentric circles that it gets more specific, as you move up the hierarchy, the AVA system isn't hierarchical in any way. So the only thing that you are required to do on the label is if there's a registered AVA and you want to claim that you're in that AVA and you want to put that on the label, you just have to have that AVA, the county that you're in, and then the state. So that's, but I actually like the AVA system because you can absolutely get quite specific in terms of knowing directly where the wine's coming from. So you have a vineyard designate, you have a small AVA like Rock Hill or Dry Creek, and those AVAs are very meaningful. In Sonoma County, we've got Carneros, we've got Russian River, we've got Dry Creek, we've got Chalk Hill, we've got Alexander Valley. Those regions have extremely significant terroirs that are meaningful, and I can tell you a Russian River Pinot Noir when I taste one immediately, versus a Carneros Pinot Noir. Very distinctive. So it's not to say that they don't. The problem now is that there's been a proliferation, and so people are like, oh well, are these more meaningful? And I'll finish here. People have recognized that it's essentially a marketing technique to be able to say, we've got this small AVA. So people are trying to, create these tiny, tiny AVAs for no reason other than marketing. And there was recently an AVA granted where there's only one winery in that AVA. So it's like, why are we doing this? You can just say it's from that producer. You don't need that AVA,
Yeah, I suppose like similar like the Bulgari case in Italy, like many years ago when they started like with like a single wine which stepped outside of like the traditional DOC system and decided they wanted to do things differently from the classical Chianti wines that they used to do. And yeah, what happened is like they brought them back in, right? They created like a DOC Bulgarian, which was just one wine, but like obviously that has grown since. And yeah, and I agree with you, obviously, to an extent. It is it's an element of branding, of marketing as well. And it's like it helps like the smaller ones and like it helps to stand out a bit. Obviously, once you get like a big enough name, then do you really need that actually? So that Yeah, I suppose you could argue both ways.
Well, and I guess the counter argument for me, like one of the reasons I like the non-hierarchical nature of the AVA system is that it just, you, if you know the wine, then you know what it is. Mm. I feel like part of, I mean, the challenges with trying to keep track of the Italian, the French, and the German system. And then of course, you know, even within France, Burgundy and Bordeaux having completely different, you know, crew systems, I mean, look, I'm a wine industry professional that sells imported wines, and I have a tremendous amount of difficulty trying to keep track of it in my head. I don't claim to be a sommelier, and I find it very, very challenging to, you know, figure out, okay, well, when you're comparing different regions, what does DOC mean over here compared to IDT over here? It's like, so that is challenging. I recognize the different countries and such, but it's, you know, I think we sidestep that issue by just saying, hey, this is a, you know, Dry Creek Valley Zinfandel, and you know it's going to be fruity and jammy if you know Dry Creek, you know?
Yeah, it's always a difficult story when you talk about like the system, and it's something that has grown over so many years. Like if you look
right.
You just mentioned like the classification system, you wouldn't even have to go as far as like Burgundy and Bordeaux. Just in Bordeaux in itself, it's like they have the different classification systems.
Exactly.
Ones are set in stone, kind of like others are get reviewed every 10 years. Then you have like the cru system, Bourgeois, where they have like, but like, as you said, like it can be very confusing. Obviously then it begs the question, or it's like brings up the question, is like, does it still serve a purpose, or is like,
of course the great chateaus would tell you it does.
Well, it depends on where you sit, you know. It's like if you look at the price development, or it's like if you look at tasting results, and you have like just in Medoc where you have like a classic the classification of 1855, the famous one, you know. It's like, yeah, you have like Premier Cru, like the highest of the first tier, is like there's like fifth tier wines now that cost kind of the same and kind of almost promise the same quality. So
that's also where, you know, it helps to be so incredibly knowledgeable. Our wine buyer, Adrian Noir, I mean, he truly is amazing. Part of the problem with the Cru system is that because it was set in stone so long ago, you'll today, you know, have a clove, and it's like right next door is a vineyard that wasn't designated, but so it's a fraction of the price. And we always make sure to source those kinds of wines and call that out, because I mean, truly, if it really, and if it's grown directly next door to, you know, to the fabled vineyard, the terroir is obviously going to be very, very similar. And the wines, if they're competently made, can be equally expressive at terroir. So, you know, and that there again is kind of a good example of why, you know, I think that the non-hierarchical nature of the AVA makes more sense, because if you're making wine from a given region and it's of a good quality, then it commands that price point regardless of its designation,
yeah.
You know? So, and that's also being, you know, a leg up for up and coming producers to be able to be recognized for making quality wines and growing, you know? So I think that's one of the benefits. I love this debate. This is one of my very favorite topics.
I entirely agree with you. It's like you can talk about it for hours and days, and it's like you always come up with different angles, and it's like there's really no end to it. But like, for the sake of our conversation here, because like I know your time is precious, you got like stuff to do, I'd like to move it on, because obviously what becomes evident here is like you know a lot about the industry. I already said like you had like a long, you have your own long personal history in wine, and you have a consultancy in Jurassic.wine. What is it you do exactly there? I mean, I had a look around, but maybe you can tell a little more about it.
Yeah, it's funny. We all kind of, one of the things that I love about the wine industry is that it really, I mean, and I think one of the reasons that people are drawn to it, and then once they find the wine industry, they have a hard time leaving, is because it is so expansive. I mean, there's, There's the viticulture side, which is a whole world of botany and soil science and, you know, biology. Mm. There's the winemaking side, which is all about, you know, chemistry and cooking and kind of, you know, honestly, yeah, like a artisanal, you know, it's a beverage that's, you know, it's all about the palate and your own personal sensory experience, and your ability to translate, you know, the grapes into that style. And there's so much to learn in that process. There's the whole sommelier aspect of it, learning about the wines of the world. There's the business aspect, which is equally fascinating, and where I spend most of my time. It's, I mean, wine is a very unique product. And then there's also the, you know, the marketing side, which really isn't just about, you know, it's a very competitive landscape, but it also goes all the way down to the bottle and the packaging. And so and every single one of those disciplines is an endlessly deep well where you could just spend you could spend an entire career learning about that one discipline. Mm-hmm. So working for my uncle, who himself is an he's the real deal. He's an old Sicilian guy and he's got the handlebar mustache. And I mean, he looks the part. So he was quite the mentor growing up. And so I started working with him at a pretty young age. I think my first harvest, I was 16. And I really did start as a cellar rat and work my way up through the business. But where it all ties together is that we do what's called custom crush as a business. So essentially we'll make wine on behalf of other people as a client, excuse me. And so what that allowed me to do though was when new clients would come, it allowed me to integrate all the different disciplines that we were working on, because I mean, it is a cliche to the extreme. People would come from, the wine bug would bite them, and they would come from all over the world from successful careers and, you know, microbiology and finance and, you know, everything, usually successful professional fields that are high stress jobs, think that they're gonna have a low stress job starting a wine brand. I have absolutely no idea where to start. And so holding their hands through the whole setup and the regulatory side and conceiving of what's going to be a successful brand. And then like, you know, hey, are you really sure that you want to pay $10,000 a ton for these Cabernet grapes? You know, there's that whole aspect to it. And so we worked with probably, in my career at Deerfield, you know, maybe worked with about 30 different clients, going all the way from, you know, here's our idea for our brand to here's the wine in the bottle, you know, help, what do I do with it? So I just learned a lot along the way. And so when I started my own brand, it was just kind of natural that I would offer that to other people. These days, I mean, as CEO of the Wine Spies, I find myself, you know, that's more than a full-time job. But I'm very happy to sell a little bit of Jurassic wines. And in general, if people have any questions for me in the industry, I'm an open book. I'm more than happy to just help people. And I guess the last thing I'll say about that is the thing that I found that I actually like the most in everything is label design.
Yeah.
And the wine bottle itself. What I love so much about it is that, first of all, everyone knows that the label, the bottle on the shelf speaks so much, you know, and even no matter how sophisticated we are or as unsophisticated as we are with our wine palates, the bottle still matters to us. It still matters, you know, it really does. And what I love is that it's when you do the label design on the screen, and I actually do the graphic design, when you do it on the screen, it might be a two-dimensional image. It might be very simple. It might just be like a black diamond with some very simple letters, black on white. But what translates onto the bottle is the texture, the finish, what kind of paper, was it embossed? Did it have a gloss put on it? So it really is kind of an art of not just seeing the actual design on the screen, but then how that gets translated to production. And then you meet you're confined by the realities of materials, the practicalities of, you know, putting things on a three-dimensional bottle and how it's applied, the shape of the bottle, all of these little things, you know, make it a really interesting puzzle. And then if you're trying to develop a package that's also economical, then, you know, you're trying to figure out how it can work with, you know, limited materials and budgets. I think that part of it is just really, really fun. So, you know, I ended up running a company, and I have an amazing team of people that I love working with. I mean, I'm just so happy to work with such incredibly talented, competent, wonderful human beings. But if I could do anything, I would probably just do label design. We're putting together a new brand for Wine Spies. It's actually going to be Wine Spies' first brand. It's very cool. It's called Enigma. And so it's based around, you know, because we're a bunch of wine spies, right? So we had to figure out the spy angle, but we didn't want it to be too on the nose, too obvious. So we like the Enigma thing. Are you familiar with the Enigma machine? Probably.
Yeah.
So that is a great story to it. So what we did is there's a code printed on the front of the label, a secret code, and then on the back there's a QR code you can scan, and that will bring up our website with a virtual Enigma machine. But the way the Enigma machine, so it's like a typewriter, but the way the Enigma machine worked was that you had to know the preset configuration of the rotor dials before you start. And so where are our rotor dials printed? It's on the cork. So you have to open the bottle So you can see the combination, and then you can use the Enigma machine to decode it. I think it's pretty cool. That's kind of like the creative packaging that, you know, really that I get excited about.
No, it's a great story. It's like it sounds like you guys are having a lot of fun, and I think that's important, and you kind of get that across very well. And I'm also fully on board with you with like the importance of like designing a nice label, because you see so many great wines and new things. Yeah. Like they've spent so much time and money like producing something like that, but the label itself or the bottle looks like it's just like a bit dull, doesn't say anything. And I agree with you, it's like eventually it's like when you, even for the educated consumer, when you're standing in front of like, I don't know, hundreds of bottles, you are attracted by like a nice label. But the question obviously now for you is like, how difficult is that to kind of get across when you talk to a client, because there's time, there's money involved and everything, and
it's almost impossible. Well, talking to a client, I think clients are, in my experience, people have been quite receptive when it comes to the packaging. I mean, I've yet to meet somebody with, when it came to the label, everyone has ideas, but it's such a technical process that, and everyone wants it to be a good label. I just have happened to work with people that are pretty trusting, so I haven't had a lot of pushback there. But what I can say, I mean, it really sucks. I mean, so our site, if you go to winespies.com, you'll see that every single day, I mean, we write a tremendous amount about each wine. I mean, we cover the winery in depth. We cover we write a lot of the story behind it. We do a very detailed and in-depth review. We put a lot of work into it. And so consequently, you know, people that are on our email list, you know, they trust us, and they read the content because it's interesting to them. And then on top of that, you know, I really believe that we sell very delicious wines. So people over time trust us that, okay, like if we're saying that this is this kind of wine, they trust us that it's going to be a good wine. So the reason I say that is, when we taste those wines and we'll have 30 wines on the table, I mean, it sucks because we will have, you know, one wine that the price is right, the story is right, you know, the wine is delicious. We love the wine. If the label sucks, I mean, we can't sell it. We cannot sell it. And even though we've built this rapport with our customers, some of our customers have been with us for 10 years. And even if we say like, trust me, are you this kind of Cabernet person? I know the label sucks. Just buy this wine. You will not regret it. People still don't buy it. Like the label has to be right. So, you know, it's really just like, it just has to be right. We had a wine just last week that I could just tell it wasn't a horrible label, but you just didn't want to pick it up. And you know what? It did not do well. And we're like, the wine was so good and it was such a good deal. We're like, people just try this wine, they'll love it and be so happy with it, but it just did not do well.
Yeah.
And that happened. So I think it's, you know, for a new producer, that's just one of the things that you have to get right, you know. And also this is really where the packaging thing comes in, where it's like something can look awesome on the screen. The designer will show this. I know this is what happens. The designer shows it to them and they see it on the screen and they're like, oh yeah, that looks great. But they go with the cheap paper, cheap material, you know, and it doesn't translate well to the bottle. And so even though it was pretty, the actual effect on the physical bottle doesn't look classy. And you know, that's what I really like, is trying to figure out. And what's remarkable is how you can have such simple design, utterly simple design, and that translates into completely classy package just because of the material itself that you have, you know?
Yeah, I was like, we could talk about it fast, but like, if you had to pick like one label, what's your favorite label?
That's such a hard one. Oh dear. Well, just in terms of the artistry of it, there's a company in Napa called Etched Images, and they individually carve into the glass and then hand paint into the glass. So like Dariush, they'll do that on, you know, the large format bottles. So the Dariush has some incredibly beautiful bottles. I mean, just the cost of the artwork, their individual artworks basically cost hundreds of dollars to have them do it. But I mean, it's second to none. I mean, it's just, the packaging is just so beautiful. In terms of something more reasonable, I probably shouldn't say this, but there's a company called Stranger and Stranger, and they're very, very famous. They've got offices in New York, London, Paris, San Francisco. Probably the most acclaimed design firm, and they're the best, and they know it. but they do consistently produce incredible labels.
Huh.
I think the augmented reality thing is pretty cool. I mean, it's obviously the hot topic, but I think it is pretty cool. I think there's some unique storytelling abilities with it. And I think we'll see some cool things happen. You know, I think the 19 Crimes success with it was, you know, I think there's a little bit of a trendiness to it that will fade, but I think long-term, you know, not just for wine, I think that there's some pretty amazing stuff that can happen with the augmented reality that we'll see more of. Because, I mean, that's the thing, is that, you know, what is the label if not an opportunity for the wine to speak for itself on the shelf? So the opportunity for a producer to, you know, have someone pick up their phone and, you know, be able to like really truly see so much more than behind the label. And if that's also presented in a beautiful, engaging way, I think that there's a lot there, and we'll see a lot more of that. And I think it'll actually be a challenge for smaller producers to kind of keep up, because, you know, it'll be hard to compete with really big, you know, well-funded producers and wine conglomerates that can spend a lot of money making that kind of content super engaging. But then again, I mean, those boutique producers, at least in the United States, they're not really on our grocery store shelves anyway. So,
Yeah, but I suppose it's like, that's what we've seen, like with virtual tastings and stuff like that, or it's like, where it's obviously more difficult for a small producer to put something together that looks great and adds value, and it's much easier for like someone who's got a lot of firepower and a lot of resources to pour in and do something amazing. But on the other hand, it's like, I've seen like a few things that it's like, even like for a small producer, like if it's done in a great way and it managed to get across like, yeah, the beauty of the winery or the the joy that is in their wine, or it's like just have like some kind of weird angle to it. It's like you can still do that, but obviously, yeah, the resources, especially when it comes to the technological solutions, is like a, is a factor that you can't argue with. Sorry, go on.
Oh, I was just thinking, like, one thing that's interesting there is also the technology as it improves for manufacturing. There's economies of scale. I mean, it's pretty amazing. Like, you know, the silkscreen printed bottles where the it looks like it's painted on directly, not the paper label. Mm-hmm. That used to be extraordinarily expensive. And the cost, because, you know, there's been enough of a consolidation of manufacturing in kind of the wine country areas, and then the equipment's essentially paid for, that nowadays you can get a silkscreen bottle for often the same price as a paper label, which simply was not the case. It used to be five times more expensive for a silkscreen bottle, and nowadays we're seeing that with all kinds of printing techniques, for a hot stamp where you can do the embossing and the foil at the same time. So the cost of all these things are coming down, and you know, for someone that really appreciates the beauty of the bottle like me, it's great. I mean, I see more and more wonderful bottles, more creativity all the time. And just, I find it endlessly fascinating what people come up with.
I think like a bottle of wine is a combination of things, and it's like you, how it speaks to like the different senses of humans. It's like you also have like a bottle in itself and the packaging, and like, and it's all part of it. And it's like, obviously there's like there's an entirely different discussion about like screw caps and cork and stuff like that. But I also say, like, always say, like, well, you also have to kind of like factor in the fact that cork is like, it adds just like to
it,
the
it just does.
Experience. And like, but I understand completely the argument that is in favor of like screw caps. So like, I'm not getting into this.
That's one of my favorite ones too. I mean, my family did a really high-end reserve Cabernet and a screw cap in 2009. And, you know, we used a membrane technology. It's worked exceptionally well. Those bottles are drinking phenomenally today, actually significantly better than some similar Cabernets that we'd done with the cork at that time. The technology is obviously on par, if not in some cases better than cork technology, putting aside the whole cork taint issue, just in terms of actual ageability in the screw cap. The convenience factor is obvious, and the fact that this has been viable, documented, like that, if there was a mystery 20 years ago about how well wines will do with a screw cap, that mystery has been settled. You know, now we know it works. So it really just comes down to, like you say, that intangible feel of pulling that cork. And you know what? I have the hardest time getting my head wrapped around the high quality Cabernets of the Barossa Valley. I cannot spend $100 on a screw cap Cabernet and just be like, oh, I'm so happy to open this bottle. It just feels wrong, and I don't know if that will ever change. And I'll tell you what, I will put up with so many bad bottles of corked wine just so that I can have that pop. I can intellectually appreciate the alternative packaging, but I'll never personally think I'll be able to get away from that. And what we've seen is the technology's been around for years, and still people are putting corks in bottles to this day. And corks are very expensive. So, you know, if the fact that people are doing that, you know, obviously consumers want it.
Yeah. It's certainly an element. I fully appreciate like that we have been talking a long time, and I could talk with you for hours about so many things. But like one final question before I let you go is like, so what was the best deal if you had to like choose just one you did in Wine Spies? What is like the one that remains with you over the years and then you will still talk about it in 20 years?
Oh God, that's really hard one too. Oh, I wish I was prepared.
What's your favorite?
I know it seems ridiculous and self-serving, but Deerfield Ranch Winery is my family's winery, and some of our top deals have actually been a Deerfield Ranch ranch winery wine.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think of like what was just such a coup. We've had some truly incredible Napa wines over the years, including like Dana Estates, and some noteworthy wines. I mean, to be perfectly honest with you, my favorite wines that we sell is when we sell a lot of a local family owned producer, because, you know, first of all, the wines themselves can be phenomenal. So like, I'm thinking specifically of Peterson Vineyard. I mean, it's just, they're a Dry Creek Valley producer. It's a small family place, just great people. But over the years, because we've had our operatives have bought from us for, you know, literally as long as we've got customers that are 10 years have been with us. Mm-hmm. So when we feature same producer over and over, they get to know it, you know? And so we've really been responsible for helping some of these smaller producers establish a following. And it is just, it feels so good when, you know, we're able to just sell a mountain of Peterson Vineyard Zinfandel. And, you know, I get to go see Jordan and give him his check and he's just so happy and we're so happy. And so those are the ones that feel the best. Mm-hmm. And typically the really, really highly sought after wines come to us through a distributor, and it just doesn't, you know, it's even though it feels great to have a big day, it just doesn't have that same satisfaction as being able to work with the smaller producers. So I'm sorry if that was a bit of a cop out.
I think there was a great answer and a great way to close this great conversation.
It's been so much fun.
Crew, thank you so much for taking the time. It was really great talking to you.
Let's do it again sometime.
Cheers.
Good night.
And that is all for today. Great stuff from Agent Crew. If you want to know more about the stuff they do at Wine Spice, if you want to tap into his knowledge and expertise and work with his consultancy, Jurassic Wine, or simply want to know more about the wine his family winery produces, you will find everything in the show notes and more. Well, thank you for joining us.